All right, questions from the fine folks on X. And thank you very much for tickling my brain with your syllables and pixels. First question, what challenges will we face in society in the future when some segments of the population have a Neuralink implant and others don't? I don't know. I don't particularly care. That doesn't mean that you're right to care or wrong to care. I'm just saying I don't particularly care. All I care about is expanding the non-aggression principle and property rights. That's what I care about. Expanding the non-aggression principle, particularly into childhood, is job one, and property rights. So there is a Neuralink implant theory that you could deal with tinnitus, which would be of some benefit to me, to put it mildly, and other things. So I think it's great. Neuralink as a whole, as far as I understand it, is there not to give people superpowers, but to restore them to a state of normal functioning. So if you get laser eye surgery, it is not to allow you to see through walls or see infrared. It is to allow you to see, you know, like a normal person. That's what it is for. And so returning people to a state of normal functioning is great. You know, people can get out of wheelchairs. People can regain use of their eyes or their arms or something like that. I mean, wouldn't that be wonderful? If it is used to upgrade people, I don't know. I mean, whatever. Nature does that all the time by giving people different height, beauty, intelligence, and so on. So I don't particularly care about it. I think it's fine. I love technology that can help people, and I hope that they keep moving forward with it. All right. Would you be interested in creating a series or long-form content similar to Andrew Wilson's Debate University, but for the purpose of learning how to reason from first principles, similar to the early whiteboard videos from FDR? Well, I have a book, artoftheargument.com, artoftheargument.com. I have a book. You can also get it on Audible, artoftheargument.com. That is my instructions on how to debate and why. Define the political right and left in the pure abstract without any reference to a particular time or place. So the political right is masculinity plus the state, which means masculinity unrestrained by balancing femininity, which is why you get fascism and hypermasculinity and so on. It tends to subjugate women, tends to have a hyper-focus on athletics, physical fitness, body aesthetics, and so on. So masculinity is supposed to be balanced by femininity, and femininity is supposed to be balanced by masculinity. When masculinity gains control of the state, you get the far right. When femininity gains control of the state, that is, you know, quote, compassion and niceness and taking care of people's feelings and not upsetting people and so on. And that's fine. That's supposed to be balanced by masculine bluntness. I mean, we're a great team, men and women. When women gain control of the state, then they can enact female nature with no balancing from masculinity, which is why you get this suicidal empathy stuff. So, all right. Can you do a podcast / video about decreasing birth rates, decreasing fertility, decreasing sperm count, especially in the Western world? Studies suggest almost no one in the West will actually be able to have children naturally in 30 years. Seems like a serious problem. I've heard it both, that old line from Psych, I've heard it both ways. So I've heard that the sperm count stuff is to some degree fabricated and so on. A major issue with having children in the West is educating women and forcing employers to hire them. No problem with women working, of course. It's not a violation of the non-aggression principle for a woman to get a job. I think it's great. But when men are forced and women are forced to hire women, that is with the goal of taking them out of their reproductive years, right? So what are the powers that be say to women? They say, oh, you can't ever really rely upon a man, although it's far more rational to rely upon a man than it is to rely upon the state, because the state can't love you and the state's going to run out of money. So it's a bad idea to rely on the state. So they say to women, well, you got to go to university, and we're going to create all of these non-challenging courses to put more and more women into university. We'll lend you a bunch of money. You'll have a bunch of fun. And then we'll tell you that you're never going to get anywhere in life if you don't go to university. You can't rely upon a man. You've got to get a career. Now, after you graduate from university, of course, you want to get a job. You get a job. You start working at that. You work hard at your job. And, you know, you kind of have an existence. It's a fairly solitary existence. It certainly doesn't build the foundations of a family and kids. And so, as somebody who will continually triumph the non-aggression principle and property rights, nobody should be forced to hire anybody else. Of course. Like, that's not even a question that any sane person would have to think about more than 5 milliseconds. Forcing men to hire women and forcing women to hire women, it's like forcing women to get married. It's terrible. So I don't think that the sperm count, like look into it, research it, and I don't think it's quite as bad as you think it is. So the more major issue is telling women they have to get educated, and then the education turns out to be largely propaganda and nonsense and foolishness, and then they graduate with a huge amount of debt, right? $50,000, $100,000, could be more. So then they have to work to pay off the debt, and men in general, like wise men in general, don't want to marry a woman and take on her debt, right? So if a woman, let's say she's gone $75,000 into debt to get her degree, well, a wise man who wants to marry a woman and have kids, well, he's inheriting a $75,000 liability, right? And why would a man want to pay a dowry? It's not like she took university courses in how to be a great mom and homemaker, right? That didn't happen. So she learned about, you know, white males are oppressive and Western culture is genocidal and patriarchal and colonists and exploitive. And right? So she learned to hate her culture. She learned to hate, in many ways, white males. So then if a man is evaluating a woman and she comes with $75,000 worth of debt for skills that are actually negative to him, does he want to marry her? Well, no. I mean, I went on a date with a woman once and she told me that she had $17,000 in credit card debt because her ex apparently used her credit card or something. And I never saw her again. Well, of course, I'm not. I mean, if we went further forward and she was struggling with the debt, it's like, let's say that things went further forward, we ended up getting married or whatever. The idea that I would pay off the greedy exploitation of her former boy toy is skin-crawlingly repulsive to me. Like, wouldn't that be horrible? Yes, I'd be happy to flush my precious earnings down the nutsack of your previous exploitive ex. Blech! Like, gross. And since basically leftists and Marxists control the universities, if a man takes on a woman's student debt, then he is funneling money to those who want to put him in a gulag, right? You're literally funding money. You're funding and funneling your precious hard-earned money as a man to those who would love to put you in a gulag and worse. So, no, it's gross. It's gross. So, you raise mistrust of men in women, and then you've heard this a zillion times, right? Can't rely on a man, and what if he divorces you? What if he finds a younger woman? What if he trades you in? And you haven't worked for 20 years, you're going to starve. Oh, you got to have your own income, you got to have your own... That's all, okay, well, just make... I mean, as if men, I mean, talking about Western men in particular, men all over the world, I think, as a whole, as if men haven't evolved to take care of wives and children. Like, we have not evolved to be providers and protectors, right? So, but of course, if you train women to be unpleasant and difficult and obstructive and hostile and skeptical and sarcastic and eye-rolling and, you know, then, well, yeah. I mean, if you train women to dislike men, and of course, when you say that men are in charge of everything, then women try to become like men. But women, I mean, psychologically, in terms of like just imitating, a woman who imitates a man or tries to imitate a man, I'm not talking about the trans stuff, I'm just talking about women who think that they have to act like men in order to get ahead, they end up with caricatures of manhood, right? I remember this was back in theater school, when men were asked to imitate women, right, as sort of a acting exercise. When men were asked to imitate women, you know, they flipped their hair a little, they smiled, and so on, they adjusted their boobs, that kind of stuff. It was kind of funny. But when men were asked to imitate women, they burped, they scratched, they walked around like cavemen, they made guttural sounds, like they basically turned the men into apes. And it's like, okay, well, that's not particularly elevating, to put it mildly. All right. So why are most European nations so determined to destroy their history and culture and heritage through blah, 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 right, demographics and so on? Well, it's not a choice. This is the price you pay for removing things from voluntary mechanisms and putting them into coercive institutions. So, for instance, if you want to take care of the poor, then, of course, you should take care of the poor. You should help people out. You should, you know, I provide tens of thousands of hours of philosophy for free, no ads or anything like that. So if you want to help people, then you should, by gosh, you should help people. And if you say, well, I want to help people, and therefore the government should, you know, use force to transfer resources from one group to another, from the middle class to the poor, from the wealthy to the poor, then you have taken any social control out of the transfer of resources. Of course, if you give to a charity and the charity turns out to be corrupt or does things that you don't want, then you just, well, what do? You stop. Well, of course, you stop giving money to that charity and all of that, right? So that's what you do. And so charities have to pursue objectives, right? So if you have a charity that helps out the poor in your neighborhood or in your town, then they do a good job. They get people off the streets. They get people trained and into jobs, and you help them out, help them get clean from drugs or whatever it is. So that's a good thing, right? But let's say that, let's sort of take a silly example, right? So let's say that they start importing a bunch of Nazis, right? I mean, which would go against your belief system and so on, right? Of course, right? So then if instead of helping the poor, they're just bringing in a bunch of Nazis to march down Main Street waving swastikas, then you would withdraw your support and that charity would collapse and the Nazis would not be there, right? Because they paid to come in. So when you take something from the free market and from voluntarism and you transfer it over to the power of the state, you now have no control over it whatsoever. You have no control over it whatsoever. So when it comes to taking care of people, Western people in their wisdom, they said, well, we don't want to have any control over this. We don't want to have any feedback on this. We want the government to do it, which is basically taking the unearned. Helping people, while immensely rewarding, of course, is also exceedingly difficult. It's very hard to help people. People are not poor because they lack money. Because when you give poor people money, very often they do exceedingly unwise things with that money, and then they basically stay poor. I mean, this is why there's a sort of permanent underclass in the welfare state. So helping people is complicated. And the more complicated something is, the more it should be in the free market. I mean, everything should be in the free market, but particularly the most complicated things. I mean, you could say governments can build simple roads, although it really takes forever and it's ridiculously inefficient, but they can do that. But, you know, the more complicated things need to have the coordination, intelligence, creativity, and efficiency of the free market. So the West as a whole, in its wisdom, decided to move charity and helping people from the control and feedback of voluntary charity, which you donate to, and move it into the political arena where things are enforced through laws, coercion, right? And this, of course, is wrong. It's wrong practically and it's wrong morally. And people should, if you want to help the poor, you should go help the poor. But what happened was people felt that they were guilty, they were manipulated, and they wanted something for nothing. They wanted to say, well, I'm a kind person because I support these policies and you don't actually care whether it helps the poor or not. And it just became popular. It was popularized, of course, in universities and schools and so on. It just became popular to say, gee, you know, I support the welfare state because I want to help the poor and blah, blah, blah. So then, you know, a half, two-thirds, sometimes three-quarters of the budget is just these income transfers in countries. People talk about the military budget, which is, of course, is big, but it is mostly about transferring money from one group to another through the force and power of law, which means it has passed beyond the control of the citizens, and it is now in the control of the government. And once things are in control of the government, almost certainly they will turn in directions you do not want. And unfortunately, the generation, the boomers, right? The generation that made all these decisions. Boomers? No, I shouldn't quite say that. I mean, I shouldn't quite say that. So 1945, 1965, this stuff came in, 64, so they're 19 or 20 and so on, right? So fairly new and not a big voting block. But let's just say, right, the generation or generations, the greatest generation, the boomers, they got all the benefits of all of this, and it is their children and grandchildren who are paying the price. It's their children. So we said, certain groups are underrepresented in these professions, so we're going to force people to hire them, and we're going to cause massive legal obstacles if they don't. And then this is now metastasized into, you know, males and whites generally not getting hired. So it's bad. But people are like, oh, well, we want to fix this problem. And then rather than get to the root of the problem and really work to fix it from the ground up and change things for the better in a more permanent way, they just turned it all over to the government. Just turned it all over to the government. And then the government does not have any interest in solving the problem. Right? Charities have to solve problems in order to get funding. I mean, if there was a charity that said, you know, we're going to deal with these 100 homeless people and you know, at least half of them are going to get into jobs and housing, and you donate for that, oh, great. And if they do a good job, you'll keep donating and so on. And the charity will have to find a way that if they give money to people who are poor, right, they'll have to find a way to avoid the inevitable problem that if you give money to people who are poor, people will stay or become poor in order to get that money. Right, so if you say, "Oh, gee, well, you know, if you have an income of $10,000 a year or less, you know, we'll give you $10,000." Well, people with less than $30,000 are going to drop down because they'll get $20,000 without working if they drop down to 10. Right, and people who are 20, we say, "Oh, well, they won't want to drop down." It's like, well, they will because they drop down to $10,000, they get $10,000, they're back to 20. People who are 30 say, well, why would they do it? They're still down $10,000. It's like, yeah, well, but they're up not having to work. So the problem is when you give money to people for being poor, people have an incentive to be poor, of course, right? Charities need to find a way to solve that problem. It's a very challenging and complex problem, which requires a lot of balancing of incentives and so on, right? And one of the ways they used to do this in the Victorian era when charities were run by the church is that if a woman had a child out of wedlock and the man had promised to marry her, she got pregnant, he just abandoned her, he was a bad guy, there wasn't anything particularly obvious or whatever, right? Then they would give her charity, but if she had another child out of wedlock, they wouldn't. Or if the woman had no direction towards marriage but had unprotected sex with a guy, coital sex, then, you know, there would be some questions, right? And so when you really want to help the poor, you want the poor to make better decisions, which means that when they make bad decisions, they're going to have to suffer. Some people learn by reason. Most people learn by bitter negative experience. So in order to help the poor, you have to permit the poor to suffer. But then if the poor are suffering, and particularly, you know, women's nature to help plus the state, right? So women's nature to help used to be restrained by men controlling the resources for the most part. So women would want to help and men would say, you know, we can't, right? Like this sort of example I've mentioned a bunch of times about, you've got just enough food for your family for the winter. Your neighbors who didn't plan come knocking on the door in February. The woman wants to take them in. The man is going to say, I'm sorry, I've done the math. We can't. We can give them lunch and that's it. And so that used to balance things out, right? So women would want to help others, which is great. And they would remind men of the need to help others because men can be a bit brutal and meritocratic that way. And that's helpful. But then men would say, ugh, you know, I don't think that's a good idea because of X, Y, and Z. And so this would balance things out, right? But now that women have gained control of the state and have really, since they got the franchise, they can indulge their desire to help people without any male restraint or even any financial restraint because it's just debt and unfunded liabilities. So how do you help the poor? Well, you've got to give them money, but not so much that you create an incentive to be poor. You've got to balance things out. And if people don't obey the rules, like if it says, you know, we'll give you housing, but you have to get a job. And if they take the housing but don't get a job, you got to kick them out of the housing. And that's tough. Because then they're back out on the street and people say, oh my God, the poor person on the street, want to help them. So people have to suffer in order for people to be helped, right? I mean, if the degree is going to mean anything, people have to fail if they don't work. So it's not just that all of Europe has sort of lost its mind or whatever. What's happened is that they turned over resource transfer to the state, which means they now have zero control over resource transfer. And of course, a lot of the domestic population, even prior to a lot of immigration, became addicted to the welfare state. And therefore, if you try to change the welfare state or move it back to private charity, people will lose their minds and riot. And then that will be bad. It's a bad look. And this is why you should just follow the non-aggression principle and property rights. And that way, these kinds of things won't happen. And people have decided not to do that. They decided to violate the non-aggression principle. They decided to violate property rights. Two sides of the same coin, right? And the wages of sin are a disaster, right? Here, can you explain why young men commit suicide generally? I cannot. Maybe I could do some research and so on, but I would hesitate to put out any kind of hypothesis without doing a lot of research, because it is obviously a very volatile and sensitive subject, which I appreciate. So maybe I'll think about it. Have you ever watched testimonies of people who have died and went to hell on YouTube? There are a lot where they are revived and are able to share their story. No, I don't watch testimonies of people who believe they've gone to hell any more than I would watch testimonies of somebody with schizophrenia describing the giant dragon that landed in their yard that morning. I mean, it's an interesting example of a dysfunctional mind, but I would imagine people who die, I think, I have a sort of vague theory that as you're dying, all of your emotional defenses vanish, right? So people who've done wrong, they repress that information, and that repression takes up a lot of energy, and they have to, you know, constantly push stimulus away, their conscience away, their guilt away, and reality away. So they constantly have to do that. And I think when you're dying, you end up no longer having the energy to maintain emotional defenses. Obviously, I have no proof of this, right? But when you're dying, your brain is, you know, struggling as an autonomous organ to maintain its energy. So it's going to remove its energy from where there's no direct necessity for survival and use it for core functionings like, you know, obviously controlling the breathing and heart rate and so on. So I think that your defenses get shut down, or it's possible your defenses get shut down when you were dying, which means that your conscience has full possession of your consciousness. And all the wrongs that you have done, that you have repressed, if you have done them, all the wrongs that you have done and repressed, all the cowardice, the brutality, the meanness, the pettiness, the intimidation, the lying, the, you know, all of the bad things that you've done, when you don't have any emotional or intellectual defenses against them, when the energy that fuels the repression part of your mind collapses, then all of your wrongs come pouring in like a giant tsunami of hot, guilt-ridden lava. And this is, I think, what they mean when they say about dying, your life flashes before your eyes, right? Your life flashes before your eyes. And for people who've done a lot of bad things, those bad things and the horror of who they are and what they've done, like, honestly, most people, you know, that famous line, you can't handle the truth. Most people can't even remotely handle the truth. All they are is propped up vanity, manipulation, defenses, status. They're just hollowed out. There's nothing in there but hell. And I've pierced this veil a whole bunch of times with people, both in my private life and on the show, and people have heard this kind of stuff. I've pierced through that, and you get to the hell within. Most people are repressing anything true, factual, and actual about their lives. They can't handle the truth. And when the truth, and then they are surrounded by people who, there's this whole deal, right? This whole unconscious deal called, well, we're not going to talk about the truth. We're not going to do the truth. We don't do the truth. It's not, right? We're not going to do the truth. We're going to stay as far away from the truth as humanly possible, right? And so their whole lives are set up so that they don't hear the truth. And they have this amazing instinct that if the truth comes their way, they instinctively, like a predator-prey relationship, they instinctively sniff the incoming truth and work frantically to attack and destroy the truth teller, right? I mean, I'm obviously suffered to this to some degree in my social media career. I was actually just listening to, there was a Howard Jones song I listened to quite repetitively. I think it's off his second album, Button Up and Tighten Your Lip. Button Up and Tighten Your Lip. take care what you say. Those crazy words you fling from your mouth are going to come back on you one day. And it's almost like a premonition. It's almost like a tunnel through time opened up and I saw my deplatforming when I was a teenager. So most people, and by this, like I mean the vast majority of people in the world, lie to themselves, lie to others, lie about their virtue, lie about their motives, lie about who they are, exaggerate their accomplishments and so on, right? And when the truth comes along, or if the truth is anywhere in the vicinity, they get very alert and very hostile. This is true, say, for women in a relationship. If a woman's in a marriage and a higher quality female comes along, the woman in the marriage needs to eliminate from the vicinity the higher quality woman. Because if her boyfriend has access to the higher quality woman, then the boyfriend might raise his standards and leave her. He might say, oh, well, this other woman seems to be more even-tempered. This other woman seems to be more assertive. This other woman seems to be nicer. This other woman seems to be more confident. This other woman seems to be more successful or more pretty or more fertile or whatever it is going to be, right? Whatever the step up is going to be. Now, of course, the girlfriend can't say, oh, I have to get rid of this woman because I'm afraid she's going to raise your standards of what a female should be, and then you're going to leave me. She can't say that. She's going to say, oh, you know how stuck up she is. Oh, do you notice how she always flips her hair? Oh, she's such a fake. Oh, do you know she's... And they should take her out of the vicinity, right? Which is this sorting mechanism, right? Where in terms of quality, right, the minus 10s are around the minus 10s, the plus 10s are around the plus 10s, and, you know, all the numbers in between. There's this constant shuffling mechanism and sorting mechanism where people eliminate those below them unless they need them for vanity props, and they eliminate those above them because they're concerned that the higher standards make them feel bad. Some people just, there's this relentless sorting in society as a whole. I mean, I remember a friend of mine many years ago was having trouble with his girlfriend, his living girlfriend. And their trouble was about sex. He wanted more sex, and she was going through a low to no sex time frame. And I remember she was talking to me and she said, oh, it's so bad. I have to make sure the Victoria Secrets catalog never crosses his vision. The Victoria Secrets catalog never crosses his vision. So she would go to the mailbox. And I mean, I don't think that they themselves were big consumers of the Victoria Secrets catalog. But, you know, back in the day, right, if you move into a place and the previous owner, they have these subscriptions, which they often don't cancel. And so, to handle a bading or whatever it is. So they would get these Victoria's Secrets catalog and she would go to the mailbox and she would take the Victoria's Secrets catalog and she would stuff them at the bottom of the recycling bin so that he wouldn't see them, because she was concerned that if he sees the Victoria's Secrets catalog, that he would get turned on and want to have sex and they'll have a fight, they'll have a conflict. And for women who are, and this is true for men as well, it's a little bit more common with women, I think, but for women who are having sexual problems with their boyfriend or husband, they want to studiously avoid anything that might turn their boyfriend or husband on, because then he might want to have sex and then blah, 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 right? So all of those lies, those manipulations, this misdirection, this all this, every time you've escalated out of pettiness, every time you've attacked someone unjustly, all right, right? I mean, I'm not perfect, far from it. So most people have done countless pretty nasty, horrible, negative, petty things in their life. They've been unjust. They've lied about people. They've gossiped. They've attacked people unjustly. They've ghosted people and so on, right? They've done some pretty terrible, wretched, bad things, and they keep it all suppressed. And they keep it all suppressed so that they don't have to deal with their conscience and change their behavior. But then, when they're dying, the conscience cracks through, the conscience breaks through. And I think this is if you, right, so when people die, they say, I'm going to heaven or I'm going to hell. Now, if you've lived a good life, I think that you don't actually have that much to, you haven't had that much repressed. And I think if you've lived a good life, one of the benefits is a relatively peaceful end, because there aren't all of these demons of dysfunction on the other side of the wall of conscience that break through when your brain is failing, right? It's like the wall collapses and the orcs of conscience charge through. So when people die and they say, it was hell, I assume, and what is the idea? The idea is that if you do bad things, you go, if you do bad things and you don't repent, right? Because if you repent, it means that you accept that you did bad things and you want to learn from them and do better and so on, right? So, you know, if you cheated on your lover, then you feel bad, you feel terrible, you feel wretched, you go and take your lumps, you recognize how ugly it would be if they cheated on you, and you learn your empathy, and you go through the ringer, right? And then you don't cheat on people again, right? Because it's so bad. If you're selfish, then you recognize finally, hopefully, the effects that your selfish behavior has on others, and then you make a vow to be better off and to do better, right? And that may mean a complete rewrite of all your social relationships and so on. So this idea, of course, that people, when they're dying, they go to heaven or they go to hell, has to do with whether they've learned from their bad deeds and reformed. So I think Christianity or other religious texts that say, when you're dying, you go to hell or you go to heaven, I think comes from a very real place, that people who've done wrong in their life, and I don't know what happens to your sense of time when you're dying, right? So, I mean, we've all had these dreams that seemed to go on forever. There was a woman in a coma for a relatively short period of time, and she had an entire vision that she'd lived for, like, I don't know, 7 or 10 or years or whatever, and she'd raised a bunch of kids, and she woke up, and it hadn't even been that long. So I don't know what happens to your sense of time when you're dying, but I assume it distorts considerably. So it could be that when you're dying, there's this rapid fire and feels like hours or days or weeks or maybe even longer. It feels that way, where all the wrongs that you've done come back to haunt you, and you are tormented by the conscience that finally has its full ravaging access to your entire personality without defenses, because the defenses have shut down because your brain is shutting down. You know, they in a spaceship, they'll always turn off the non-essential things, right? You don't turn off gravity, or you don't turn off oxygen, right? You turn off the non-essential things, right? So when people are dying, I think that all of their bad deeds go stampeding like bladed hoofed horses across the tender nutsack of their consciousness, and they feel like they're in hell. Whereas people who've lived a pretty good life, I think it's relatively much more peaceful. Oh, there was bright light and ancestors and so on, right? I think it's more peaceful. So when people die and they come back and they say, oh my God, I went to hell for like 2 days or a week, or right? And then be, oh my God, this hell. It's like, well, I don't think there's a physiological explanation. Hopefully that will be proved at some point. All right. How would you decide between a guaranteed mediocre life or a slim chance at wild success? How would you decide between a guaranteed mediocre life, easy living, quiet die, right, from a room with a view, or a slim chance at wild success? Slim chance at wild success. I think do what you're most passionate about that does the most good in the world. Do what you're most passionate about that does the most good in the world. So I don't view these as false dichotomies. And I talked about this last night. Either you have the pain of potential failure, or the actuality of failure should it occur, either you have all of that, or you have the pain of regret. Either if you ask the girl out and she says no, it feels bad. If you don't ask the girl out and she ends up dating someone else, you feel bad for regret. So it's just choose your pain, right? And I think that the pain of rejection and the pain of failure, which is not forever, right? If there's some woman, she's the girl of your dreams, and you don't ask her out, she ends up going out and marrying someone else, that pain of regret lasts the rest of your life, off and on, right? Whereas if you ask her out and she says no, that stings, and then it goes away, and you don't have the pain of regret. So avoiding risk is like eating junk food. It feels good in the moment, costs you appallingly in the long run. So I think that's important. That's important. Like before I met my wife, I remember there was a woman or two that I was very interested in, and I would sometimes still think about them from time to time. And of course, I haven't really thought about that at all since I've been now married for like 24 years, and it's a lovely, lovely marriage. But I was like, oh, I should have. But it was tough because one of the women had a boyfriend and all of that, so I didn't want to pursue that. Anyway, so I think that if there's a woman you really think you'd be great with, you're really attracted to her, she thinks she's really wonderful, if you don't ask her out, then you get regret for the rest of your life. And that's bad. Whereas if you do ask her out and she says no, you get stung, it hurts, it's painful, and then you learn something, which is you like someone who doesn't like you back. And that's important, right? So if you like someone who doesn't like you back, it's really important to figure out why. And most times it's because she's pretty, has a great body, or is just charismatic without virtue and so on. So she's, you know, high status and looks great and has a great laugh and so on, but maybe there's not much substance there. And so if you really like someone who doesn't like you back, that is an opportunity to learn and to grow, right? Right, to learn and to grow. So, all right. Somebody says, you advocate against forgiveness without prior repentance from the perpetrator. Yes. That means somebody has to repent in order for me to forgive them. Sure. Could it be possible that most people just can't walk between resentment and forgiveness? So in terms of total human suffering, it is better just to forgive. What? Could it be possible? So the could it be possible is kind of a bullshit trick of sophistry, right? Is it possible, right? So let's sort of use this on someone. Let's say that Bob has a successful podcast about masculinity, right? And then someone says, is it possible that someone, a man who listens to your podcast, might beat his wife? Right? Is it possible? Now, if Bob says, no, it's not possible, then that clearly is a cop because he can't know that for sure. He doesn't even know everyone who listens to his podcast, right? So someone says, is it possible, Bob, the man-friendly podcast host, is it possible that one or more of your listeners has beaten their girlfriends or wives? Now, Bob is caught, right? Bob is caught. Because what does Bob say? It's a false dichotomy, right? So if Bob says, no, it's not possible, then, of course, the person who's asking the question will almost certainly have some fact or information to disprove that. Well, Bob, there's this guy Joe, and Joe listens to your podcast, and Joe beat his wife, so you're wrong about that, right? And then you look like you don't know, or you're clueless, or you're defensive, or whatever, right? Whereas if Bob says, well, yes, it's possible that someone who listens to my podcast about masculinity has beaten his wife. Yeah, it's possible. And I don't do false dichotomies. So if somebody were to say to me, Steph, is it possible that someone who listens to your podcast has committed a crime? I would say, I don't understand the question. I don't understand the question. So, well, no, it's a yes, no. Is it possible, right? I'd say, no, I still don't understand the question. And I would use an analogy, and I would say, if I was selling a diet book and somebody asked me, is it possible that someone has read your diet book and not lost weight? Right? It's a question that I don't understand because it's a gotcha. Is it possible that someone has read your diet book and not lost weight? Ryan said, well, it's possible. Well, then your diet book can't really be that effective. Like, I don't understand the question. So I would return the question and saying, well, what do you mean by possible? Is it within the realm of physical reality that someone could read my diet book or listen to a masculine positive podcast and either not lose weight or beat his girlfriend? Are you saying, is it physically possible? And if the person says, well, that's what I'm asking, then I would say, I'm not sure why you would need to ask that question. Anything that is physically possible could happen, like by definition. So the reason I don't understand the question is you're saying, is something that could happen, could happen. It's a tautology. Is something that is possible, possible? Since it is certainly possible that someone who listens to a podcast beats his girlfriend or someone who reads a diet book doesn't lose weight, since it's physically possible, I don't understand the question. Because if you're saying, is something that is possible, possible, then I don't understand. I don't understand why you would need to ask that question. Because you're asking, if something could happen, could it happen? So I don't understand the question. The answer to the question is embedded in the question. And I'm not sure if the answer to the question is embedded in the question, I'm not sure why you would ask me the question. Either you're manipulative or you're appallingly stupid. Like, if you don't understand, if you ask, if something is possible, could it have happened? Well, if you don't know that the answer to the question is embedded in the question, either this is a manipulative gotcha question, or you're too stupid to understand that asking if something could happen that's possible to happen, I mean, it's a tautology. You have to find something is possible and saying, is it possible? Yeah. So I don't understand the question, right? I don't understand the question. It's like saying, if I let go of something and it falls, if I let go of something, will it fall? Well, it's kind of a tautology. If you've defined, you let go of something, it falls. So if I let go of something and it falls, if I let go of something and it falls, So could it be possible that most people just can't walk between resentment and forgiveness? So in terms of total human suffering, is it better to just to forgive? Is it possible? Well, is it possible that something that could happen could happen? Yes, I will grant you that. I will. Is it possible? So birds land on tree branches. Is it possible that a bird you haven't seen has landed on a tree branch? It's like, I don't understand the question. You just told me that birds land on tree branches. So is it, and then you're asking, is it possible that birds land on tree branches? Like, I don't understand why you're asking the question. You've already told me the answer. Most people just can't walk between resentment and forgiveness. So I don't know. I don't know what any of that means. And he goes on to say, and that in not forgiving, most people just become shitey judges. Is it possible? Is it possible that the universe is expanding every second, but everything that we use to measure it is also expanding, and therefore we can't measure the expansion? Is it possible? It's like, well, you just told me it's possible. So why are you asking me if something is possible if it's possible? And it's a manipulative or sophist trick, because if somebody says, is it possible? And you say, yes, it's possible, then they say, well, you can't eliminate it, right? So it could be a thing. And it's a way of driving in the wedge and creating uncertainty. He said, in principle, I'm inclined to agree with your take. Ugh, this is gross. It's just, there's a sticky, gooey, slimy, sewage vomit manipulation. I'll tell you straight up, right? In principle, I'm inclined to agree with your take. It's not a take. I make a rational fracking argument. It's a rational fracking argument with evidence. So if you're going to say, it's just a take, you're saying, well, your opinion, your argument, your blah, blah, blah. It's like, no, we didn't even say argument. I'm inclined to agree with your take. Oh, how generous of you. How nice that you're inclined to agree with my little take. He says, in principle, I'm inclined to agree with your take, but I don't know anyone that has escaped resentment without upfront forgiveness. I don't know anyone. Should be anyone who, right? Anyone that has escaped resentment without upfront forgiveness. Well, that just means that you're surrounded by resentful people. Okay? So you're surrounded by resentful people. But that's your choice. There are people in this world who are incredibly grateful and happy and thankful for every opportunity that comes their way. So if you say, everyone around me is just resentful, and they have to grit their teeth and will themselves to forgive others because that's the only way to deal with their resentment. So if someone has done you harm and they won't change their behavior and they won't apologize and they won't make restitution or anything like that, then you can solve the problem by not seeing that person. So the forgiveness thing comes out of an inability to not see someone, right? So my mother, of course, did me great wrongs, as have others. I said my mother, right? My mother's done me great wrongs, and she has never apologized or acknowledged or will never make restitution. In fact, when I would point out that she had done great wrongs, she blamed chronic fatigue, the evil doctors who poisoned her, Epstein-Barr, and that I should have sympathy for all of her suffering and not be so selfish as to blame her for the effects of her mysterious ailments. So I certainly agree that if ostracism or not seeing people is off the table, then if you're going to continue to see people who do you wrong, who never apologize, if you're trapped with them through your own inability to review options, I get that. If you're trapped by people and you can't escape them and they're not going to change, you might as well forgive them. Because why not, right? Why not? Because if your resentment at the wrongs they've done you can't possibly breed not seeing them, then you have no leverage. You have no leverage. So, yeah. You can escape resentment, like people do you wrong, you resent them. You can escape that resentment by not seeing those people. Shocking, I know. I know. Shocking. If a fire is burning my hand, I have the option of taking my hand out of the fire, right? Out of the fire. But if, let's say, your parents wrong you, and they don't apologize, they don't make restitution, they don't admit fault, and they continue to wrong you, though probably less physically and more emotionally or psychologically, let's say that is the case. Well, if you're going to continue to see your parents, and they're going to continue to wrong you and deny your reality and so on, then I guess you can just wave this magic wand called forgiveness so that you feel a little better. Okay, but you can escape resentment of the people who do you wrong by no longer hanging out with the people who do you wrong, right? Like I remember I said I had this friend who continually told stories about silly things that I'd done in social gatherings, particularly, well, we were both single at the time, particularly with women around, and it's because I was taller and better looking and higher status, so he wanted to put me down so he'd have more access to the females and not feel like he was grabbing some leftovers. So I resented that. So I talked to him about it, and he's like, oh, you just need to have a sense of humor about yourself. It's all in good fun. Don't be so sensitive, blah, 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 blah. And so the next time he did it, I just stopped seeing him, right? Now, I wasn't, you know, entirely opposed. Like if he'd called me up and said, hey, you know, we haven't really hung out much lately. What's going on? I remember that conversation we had, and then I think I did it again, so maybe we can talk about that. I'd have called him, right? Whatever, right? But he didn't want me as a higher quality male around, so I get that. So I just stopped seeing him. So I resented him continually talking about things I'd done that were foolish without ever talking about the things I did that were wise. And in general, the things I do that are wise significantly outnumber the things that I do that are foolish. And that was the case even back then. So I was able to escape resentment by not seeing him anymore. Right? And I no longer resent him. So easy peasy. All right. So he says, on the average, maybe they get taken for some sort of a ride, but their overall life is better. I'm not talking about individual cases here, just on balance and overall human suffering levels with the average human and their average human drama / life. Yeah, okay. I mean, if people are stuck in relationships or have stuck themselves in relationships, should they forgive if the person won't ever admit fault and bringing up the fault? Like, so if you, when I brought up faults that my mother did, she would get angry and crazy and throw things around and all of that. So it was really unpleasant. So I stopped seeing her. And it's not, you know, when I stop seeing people, I'm not averse to them coming after me, right? Like if I leave, I'm not averse to people coming after me. I'm not averse to people saying, you know, geez, you know, if my mom had said, you know, the last time you brought up an issue you had with me, I ended up throwing things around and screaming at the top of my lungs. I'm sorry about that. That was really out of line. Let's, you know, take a deep breath and I'd love to chat with you. Okay, I would have called her. Yeah. Yeah. So when I walk away from people, I'm not averse to having more conversations. But in general, and I'm trying to think of sort of exceptions to this. I don't know that there really are any. Maybe they're for you, but I can't think of any for me. In general, when I walk away from people, I never hear from them again. Which means that I'm obviously, you know, I talk about things with people, and then if they don't change or improve and won't admit any fault and continue to do the behavior, then I'll walk away. And then if they let me walk away, and they don't, it's not even worth a phone call or anything like that. If they let me walk away, then it was the right thing to do because I don't matter enough to them. So if I walk away and people, I'm not worth a phone call, I'm not, you know, worth anything like that, then okay. I mean, I tell you, man, this was, I won't say it was rough. I won't say it was rough, but I certainly noticed it. I had a friend, 20 years. Yeah, 20 year friendship. Maybe a little more, a little over 20 years. And we did a lot together. We worked together. We traveled together and so on. I gave him jobs when he was down and out. And anyway, so we had some problems and I talked to him about the issues and he wouldn't change and he wouldn't this and wouldn't that. And so he called me once. I didn't call him back. And that was it. That was it. Like we used to have this thing where we would go and choose Christmas presents for people we cared about. We'd go sort of downtown, toodle around, pick up some Christmas presents. So he called me, and I didn't call him back. And that was it. 20+ years. Immense wound together lives. And he called me. I didn't call him back. And he never called again. And we've never spoken since. Isn't that wild? Now, of course, people could say, and I get that, and I've obviously, you know, anything you criticize about me, I'm almost certainly have thought about before. So people can say, well, but you didn't call him back, and you were the one who didn't call back, right? Of course. But I mean, I had told them about my issues, and I don't like it when you talk about your issues with, like, if you have problems with people, you talk about it with them. I don't like it if they then pretend that that conversation never happened. Like, oh, we're going to go downtown, to pick up some Christmas presents, blah, blah, blah. No reference to the prior conversation. So if, you know, imagine if you were dying to date some girl and you got her number and you'd gone on a couple of dates and then you called her and she didn't call back, would you just never talk to her again? No, you'd call her back and say, oh, sorry, if you missed my message, I just wanted to blah, blah. You'd call back. You'd be a little persistent, obviously not stalky, but you'd be a little persistent. So it's interesting, right? If you walk away from people, like if you have issues, they don't really change. You walk away from people. If they don't even make a phone call, if they just watch you leave and don't lift a finger, well, wasn't much there. Wasn't much there. How can you escape damnation? Well, listen to your conscience. When society becomes unraveled, is it due to people forgetting the basics? No, it's our desire for the unearned that has us shift virtue from personal action to political institutions, as I talked about before. How to solve population decline, gender wars, and political divide where women are getting more far left and men are getting more far right when the division is being funded by rival countries / globalists? Well, how to solve population decline? It's not super complicated. If you have a public platform like I do, then you talk about the reasons for it and so on, and you appeal to people's greed for happiness and virtue and comfort and, you know, so on. But the best way to deal with population decline is to get married, to have children, and to post about how wonderful it is. That's the best way to deal with population decline. Get married, have children, and post about how wonderful it is. Obviously, you know, you can blur out your kids' photos, and you probably should because nasty stuff happens in terms of kids' faces being online. But yeah, you get married, you have children, and married life is the best. And, you know, here's our children on Christmas morning, and you know, blur out the faces and all of that, and, you know, just talk about how wonderful it is. I mean, I don't think I've been shy talking about how wonderful married life is and how wonderful being a parent is and all that kind of stuff. So everybody wants these big abstract things like, how can we solve these big giant problems? Well, you know, think globally, act locally is an old saying from the environmental movement. So what you want to do is get married, have children, and tell everyone how wonderful it is. And also, you know, chide people. You know, if you've got some guy who dates and doesn't settle down, or if you've got some guy who dates, he's dated a woman for a year or two or three, and it's like, get married, man. Like, just chide people, you know, like I did this last night with the guy who was dating the Guatemalan woman, right? Just, you can chide people. You can ask them the tough questions. All right. Are you friends with Styx? If so, have you checked on him lately? He's gone off the rails lately. Hope he finds some help. Yes, I am not friends with Styx. I'm certainly not any kind of enemy or anything like that, but I sort of have a divide in my life, like before deplatforming and after deplatforming, which was, you know, other than marriage and parenthood, was sort of the most significant mid to late adult thing that happened to me. So the people who and use that phrase, reached out, we've reached out, right? So people who reached out, asked me how I was doing, if there's anything I could do, even if it was just like a private conversation or anything like that. Well, he wasn't one of those people. It's not any big criticism. He just wasn't one of those people. So no, I'm not friends with him. He does seem to not be doing super well, but I think I offered help to him, but he hasn't taken me up on it. Okay. What do you think of the notion that with some exceptions, conservatives cannot create good art? I don't think that's true. I mean, I wouldn't say I'm a conservative, but I'm certainly anti-leftist, and I've created some absolutely stupendously fantastic art. Really. I mean, freedomain.com/books, pick up the novels. They're fantastic. And if I ever come across my old plays, I publish them too. So it's not that conservatives can't create good art. It's that there's no point for conservatives to create good art. So I spent, you know, tens of thousands of hours writing novels and could never get published. I mean, once I got published, but it wasn't a big deal. So I couldn't get published. So what's the point, right? So you kind of give up, right? And I will tell you, like a couple of times when I had agents read my books, like the ferocity, the hostility, the rage that came back was really quite astounding, kind of jaw-dropping. So it's sort of like if redheaded people are banned from being stock traders, you say, well, why is it you think that redheaded people are bad at stock trading? It's like because they're banned from doing it, so there's not much point creating your skills that way. Do you like cats? I do. I do like cats very, very much. All right, but I'm not a pet person as a whole. So I like pets. I like visiting pets. My daughter and I will still occasionally go to a cat shelter and all of that. But having pets is not quite the same thing. All right, so how do you ground a nation's ontology? Now, ontology is the study, the philosophical study of being, of what applies neutrally to everything that is real, existence, non-existence, reality, unreality, and so on. Well, there's no such thing as a nation's ontology, because that's like saying, how do you ground the physics of Russia, or Russia's physics, Russian physics? It's like, well, it's either physics or it's not. It's not Russian physics, right? So I don't know. You'll have to be more specific. If you're talking about culture, that's not ontology. If you're talking about ontology, that's not national. So feel free to send your question back in with some more details. What are the chances the universe was formed by two colliding universes? Perhaps it was just a fender bender, a la how our moon was theoretically formed by a rogue planet colliding with Earth. What are the chances? What do I know? I'm a philosopher, not a physicist. So again, you want to stay away from is it possible questions. Is it possible? Is it possible to jump out of a plane without a parachute and survive without injury? Sure. I suppose so. Like if you fell onto some big giant pillowy tent thing that arrested your fall and lowered you down or whatever, right? So I don't know what the point is of what are the odds, what are the chances, what are the possibilities. I don't understand what the point is of those questions. Is it possible to jump out of a plane and not get injured? Yes. So what? It's possible, but does that mean you should jump out of a plane without a parachute? Well, no, of course you shouldn't, right? Is it possible that you can be a spendthrift your whole life and then win the lottery right before you retire and then retire in style? Yes, yeah, it's possible, but so what? No sane person spends everything they make and then plays the lottery in the hopes that they can have a comfortable retirement. Like, is it possible? The question is, will it change your decisions? Will it change your mind? Will it change your decisions? Will it change your actions? Will it change your path in life? So, I mean, let me give you an example. Is it possible that I could make a living, so back in 2005, 2006, when I was considering this stuff, is it possible for me to make some kind of living doing an ad-free philosophy podcast? Yes, it is possible. And therefore, I quit my executive career in the software field and became a philosopher online, for the most part, in person to some degree online. So is it possible? Yes. Therefore, I will change my behavior, right? Is it possible to jump out of a plane and survive with no injuries? Yes. Is that going to change your behavior at all? Are you then going to say, well, then I'm not going to do the expense of a parachute? Well, no, I'm still going to have a parachute. So is it possible the universe was formed by two colliding universes? Yeah. I don't know how to gauge or, I mean, I don't know. I mean, if you move enough variables, almost anything's possible, right? So what were these possibilities or probabilities? How will they change your behavior? Now, if the possibilities or probabilities won't change your behavior, then don't worry about them. They're not important to think about. How do you build a sane friend circle in an insane world? Well, you just got to stick to principles. Encourage people to follow rational principles and ostracize them if they don't. Can you dance? If not, what kind of a philosopher are you? I will, in fact, tell you, I can shake a tail feather, man. I was at a friend's wedding a couple months ago, and I busted several moves for like 2 hours. And it was good. There was some really good 80s stuff and all of that. And don't believe me, just watch. Song is great to dance to. And so, yes, I can dance. I spend a lot of time in nightclubs and discos and so on when I was a teenager. And I even moonwalked. I even learned how to moonwalk at one point. So, yes, I can't dance. Why are boomers such crappy grandparents? Because boomers were psyoped into selfishness so that they would go for short-term vanity, quote, morality, hedonism, rather than long-term survival of their culture, so that their culture could be dismantled under them and they wouldn't care. They wouldn't care. So thank you so much for these great questions. If you find these answers helpful, I think they're great. freedomain.com/donate to help out the show would gratefully and humbly and deeply appreciate it. freedomain.com/donate. You can also go to shop.freedomain.com for your merch, and freedomain.com/books for all the free books. Some great stuff in there. Recommend my novels in particular. Start with Just Poor. It's really, really great. And was it last but not least? It has escapeth my mindeth. So I have freedomain.com/connect to follow me on social media. All right. Lots of love, my friends. Thanks a million so much. Have a great day. Bye.